Good morning. Hi. Glad to see you all here on this humid morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about the last page of the Genjo Koan. This is my ninth talk on the Genjo Koan, and after this is done, I won't have anything to talk about, which is perfectly okay. But something will arise. Something always arises. Genjo Koan, bringing reality alive. That's the translation I'm using this week. Bring reality alive. And Koan means reality, and Genjo means bring alive. So this is by Dogen, who lived in the 13th century, who is one of our main men in our lineage, in the Zen Buddhist lineage, the Soto Buddhist lineage. He tells a story from a Chinese Zen from the 9th century at the end of this essay that I've been talking about. And I'm going to read the story and then I'll make some points about the story. Say about four or five things about the story and why he's using it to help us in our Zen practice. Not to get us smart, but to help us. Although sometimes when you read him, I wish I was smart. But I can never get smart reading Dogen, luckily. This guy is a master of the Chinese classics. He knows Sanskrit. He knows all the types of Buddhism, and then he knows how to deconstruct them. And you can't tell often whether he's deconstructing or constructing, because sometimes he's doing both simultaneously. What fun. What fun we have in Zen. Okay, so the story. Zen master Magu was using a fan. A monk approached him and asked, "The nature of the wind is ever-present and permeates everywhere. Why do you use a fan?" Magu said, "You only know that the wind's nature is ever-present. You don't know that it permeates everywhere." The monk said, "How does wind permeate everywhere?" Magu just continued using the fan. The monk bowed deeply. And Dogen has three sentences to say about this. The genuine experience of Buddha Dharma enlightenment and the vital path that has been correctly transmitted is like this. Pretty clear, huh? It's like this. Then here is a little bit of clarity. To say we should not use a fan because the nature of wind is ever present and that we should feel the wind even when we don't use a fan is to know neither ever-presence nor the wind's nature. So a few things that Dogen's saying here, right? He's reason that he's included this story. He wants to remind us about the ever-presence, everywhereness of reality. If you look at the teachings of the mystics and those who don't consider themselves mystics but are non-dualists in the East and the West, they're basically all saying the same thing. We're all saying the same thing in a different way. That's my take on it. One of the first stories that I read about non-dualism, that means not being caught by dichotomies, was a story from the Upanishads, which becomes a basis for Advaita Vedanta. And I didn't know that wasn't Zen until I'd been sitting in Zen for about 2 years, because I hadn't studied. I just sat in Zen. And here's how that story goes. It's a father and son. The father says, Tathagata Ketu, my dear boy, have you inquired about that entity by means of which even that which is not heard about becomes heard, even that which is not reflected upon becomes reflected upon, and even that which is unknown becomes known? Unable to comprehend the question, the son asked, "Oh, Father, I do not know about that. Will you please enlighten me, O revered one?" Well, you can tell when this was written, because my kids never called me revered one. I'm hoping my grandson, who is with me this morning, will learn about revered ones, but he doesn't seem to know it yet either. I think that's gate, that stuff, for our culture. That means gone. Anyway, so this wonderful son who says, "Will you now enlighten me?" The father replies, "As one who knows the characteristics of everything made of clay by studying just a lump of clay and realizes that the name and form are just the play of words, just as by knowing a nugget of gold, all that is made of gold will have been known, the various ornaments of gold are mere plays of words concerning names and forms. Just as by studying a piece of steel, everything made of steel would become known, the difference being merely the play of name and form, even though, my son, is this. By knowing which everything in this universe becomes known, the apparent differences are about multifarious names and forms. Now it is this subtle entity which all this universe has for its essence. It alone is real. That is the Atman. You are that, Svetikaku. You are that." So I read this many, many years ago. I thought, wow, can that be true? Can that be true? But for some reason, I believed it. I don't have any reason to believe it, but I saw that it was true in the Vedas, in the Upanishads, there was in the Nikayas, in Mahayana, and in Meister Eckhart. I saw they were saying this. So I thought, wow. I want some of that, right? Even though it's just this, I want it. So I started practicing. I practiced Zen, but I didn't even know. I didn't even know. Because in those days, I didn't know it wasn't Zen. I practiced it. I went to the Zen Center in San Francisco, where I'm from. And then on Sundays, I went to the Vedanta Center. Because the Zen Center was closed on Sundays because my teacher had to take care of the Japanese on Sundays. My teacher was brought over because of the Japanese congregation needed someone to minister to them, but they didn't do Zazen. So on Sunday, I don't know what they did. They probably had chanting, and I don't know what they did. I never went on. None of us ever went on Sunday. Nobody. Maybe they had movies. Probably movies. So on Sunday, I went to the Vedanta Center. So I did this for, seems like 2 years, although by the time you're my age, you know, time sort of, I'm not sure. I could go back and try to figure it out, but why bother? Why bother? So I went there for about 2 years, and then once Suzuki Roshi had a visiting monk come from Japan to talk to us. And this visiting monk was a scholar. He said, "Buddha talked about no Atman." He said, "The Atman gets in the way of practice, and the central teaching of Buddhism is no Atman." And I thought, that's funny. I went back and read my story again, and I said, "Suzuki Roshi, well, the story that I read," he said, "Oh, but that's not Zen, Tim. That's Vedanta." Oh, okay. And I thought, well, I should learn about this, but it seems the same to me. And frankly, it still seems the same to me. It still seems the same to me. But what Buddha was up to, and those of you guys who've studied Buddhism know, what he was up to is he was in a culture which had become inculcated by this idea of Atman. It had been inculcated by it. So everybody believed it. They had reified it to the point that only the Brahmins knew how to get to Atman. And we would have to hang out with them and even give them money, give them food, and we could get Atman maybe. even though Ottman was in, only they knew it. So it became very stratified, very rigid, and it was no longer just a metaphor. And that's what we have to be careful, right? We have to be careful. So we have in the history of Buddhism then, for those of you who have been studying this, and for those of you who haven't been studying this, it's all the same. We have in the history of Buddhism, 350 years later, something beginning to come up in Buddhism, in birth of Mahayana Buddhism, called Tathagatagarbha. Tathagata means Buddha. Garbha means seed. Buddha seed. Garbha means embryo. Buddha embryo. And what are the teachers saying in the awakening of faith? What are they saying in the Lotus Sutra? They're saying everybody has a seed within them. Everybody has a seed of stillness. The seed of stillness permeates the universe. It's always there. And all we have to do is wake up to the seed. Sounds a lot like Atman, doesn't it? But then all the Buddhist scholars talk about why it isn't Atman. You can read Khan's about 33 reasons about why it isn't Atman. But it seems a lot like Atman to me. It's a seed that's been covered up by our residue. Atman has been covered up by our residue of worries, by our residue of concerns, by our residues of anguish about whatever, about our family, about ourselves, about our physical health, about our mental health. It's been covered up. And so the goal, both in Vedanta and in Buddhism, is to uncover it. Uncover it. But then what happens in Mahayana? Well, human beings, we want something concrete to help us. So pretty soon, Tathagatagarbha becomes the Buddha nature. Yeah, it's within everybody, but only the priests, the guys and girls with the robes. They're the ones. You hang out with them. They have their Buddhist names. They're the ones. They can show you. Come, come, come. I can show you, right? Then we have the Chinese Zen masters coming along a few hundred years later saying, no, Tathagatagarbha, no Buddha nature, right? And we have the history of Buddhism like this going on and on and on and on until today. Because of our tendency, because we are insecure, we have a basic insecurity to want something that we can work with that is the right way, the right path. So that's the first implication of Dogen choosing this one for his last part of his essay. Secondly, I think he's using it just for the reason that teachers use these metaphors over and over again, that these metaphors are a way of introducing us to something that we can never really get intellectually, but that's always present. And a metaphorical way is the best way because it's harder to clamp down on it, although we do. Our metaphors become fundamentalism so quickly. Do you notice that? How whatever your metaphor is, how long does it take you to become a fundamentalist about a metaphor? And I'm not talking about Christianity. I'm talking about you and me, right? Talk about human culture. So, but for Dogen, as he says in the previous few paragraphs, the reason he's using this metaphor is so that we can learn to make this place our own. And that's what I talked about last time. He says, when we make this place, this very place, meaning not just this place where I'm calm, but this very place where I'm calm and not calm and anxious and not anxious and in pain and in pleasure and all, this very place, our own, our practice becomes Genjo Kōen. Our practice manifests the liveness of reality. It just manifests it. When we make this path our own, our activity naturally becomes bringing alive reality, says Dogen. So that's another way of talking about it. You could say that's also a metaphor, but it's a little less of an abstract metaphor. Making this place our own. Making our own. Not going off someplace else. But, and we want to keep going off someplace else because there's something about this place that seems not calm enough, not open enough, not good enough. And we do this in Zen too, don't we? We always do this. So when I was with my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, in San Francisco, I dropped out of college the month I was supposed to graduate. That's a great time to drop out of college. I recommend it. To go up to San Francisco and just be with him full time. Although in the city, you couldn't exactly do it full time, but almost full time. And I left my family behind and just was there. And I told Suzuki Roshi that I just wanted to practice with him. And he had been coming down to my hometown to practice with me for about a year, and I'd been going up there. And he said, "That's fine. You come practice here." And I kind of said, "And you know, my father is materialist too." I said, "He's really materialistic." He said, "Oh," he said, "he likes jewels." Well, I don't know why he said that. And then he said, "Man, don't forget, your jewel is right here. Your jewel is right here." And he said, "And it includes your father." It includes your father. His jewels are not separate from your jewel right here. I didn't really like him telling me that. That's why I'd left my father. I'd have enough of that. This is the 60s, man. Enough of that. But there he was. There he was saying that to me. And so then I lived in San Francisco for a while. I met a woman who became my wife. I practiced, and then Suzuki Roshi kept saying to me, "Well, you know, you should go back and see your parents sometime. And you should even finish college." But keep saying it. He said it about twice, but that was enough that I felt like, "God, get off my case." Because this was the 60s, and I'm still a 60s person. Linda says that if you tell me to do one thing, that's my wife, I'll always do the other thing. So I'm going to tell you a little story. So there's, on Creighton Avenue, when you just get off 94 and you go south, there's a little thing where all of a sudden it measures your speed, and you see, you know, the sign comes up. And, of course, when I see it, I always speed up. Wow, this is interesting. And Linda said, "Oh, that's so like you." So like you. That's why I had to choose Zen, because only in Zen can we get away this kind of thing. To a degree. So then I went back to college to finish with my young wife. I guess we were married by then, probably. Yep, we were. And went back to see my father once a week, which I could barely do. And the college was not so hard this time, or not so yucky this time, because I was really working on trying to make this place my very own. You know, where I was, my very own. And I had one course that I really hated, but I needed to take science to graduate. And so I thought, well, easy science will be geology, so I will take geology. But for me, it was very boring, very uneasy, because I was with all science majors in it, and I just wanted to split. I wanted to sleep through the class, but the class was at 11 a.m., so was hard to sleep through. Plus, I had reformed by then as a Zen student, right? And I was getting up early every morning to sit in those days. Well, in those days, in these days, in all days. So I began with my biology, my geology. I began when I would go to the room, the lab, the three-hour lab every week. I would just remind myself, your jewel is right here. Here's your jewel. I just needed to say that to get myself in the room. And then I looked at the rocks. Well, there's my jewel. And that was my practice. That was my practice, which my teacher had given me, but he didn't really give it to me as a formal practice. He just said it to me, and it helped. It helped. We have all kinds of practices we can use to help us. And that's what I've been talking about lately when I've been talking about the different pillars of meditation practice. And that's an example of the second pillar, meditation practice. Positive mental dharmas. Use something positive to help you come into this place and make it your very own. Because it is. But you need to use something encouraging. It doesn't have to be something formal from a mantra or a gata, but something you can use. And when I did this, I actually would touch my nose, but then I was self-conscious about doing it in front of other people. I didn't realize I'd done it on other people. So after I'd done that once, I didn't do it anymore. But then I just said it to myself. Here is the jewel. Here's the jewel. Even in these pre-Cambrian and post-Cambrian and sedimentary and igneous rocks.
You still remember.
Well, I got a D. But at least I didn't flunk and I graduated from college. So, you know, you do what you can, right? Do what you can. That's about all I remember. So, the Zen teacher who Dogen is quoting here is Magu, the one who is using the fan and advising the student. And I talked about Magu last time. I talked about Magu as being a contemporary of Rinzai, of Linchi. And I talked about Linchi being a generation ahead of Magu, although they were the same age. And I said that Magu had his own Zendo, and Linchi, Rinzai. So how would you expect Rinzai to be? If you know about Rinzai Zen, you know Rinzai was a fierce guy, right? He was fierce. So he comes, and poor Magu, who's sitting here in his seat, and he has a strong repartee, a strong encounter with Magu. And Magu then gets up, and Rinzai immediately tries to get Magu's seat. That's the kind of, these are Rinzai Zen people. We're not like that. We're so kind and gentle. We never yell or anything, except once in a while. So he tries to get Magu's seat. Talked about this last time. But Magu won't let him have it. Then what does Rinzai do? Well, Rinzai has his kisaku. So what would you do if you were Rinzai and you had your kisaku? He hits him. You know, nothing like spiritual interchange, you know. It's a little bit different kind of spiritual interchange, isn't it? So he hits him. Psh, 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 psh. I haven't hit anybody in years, but I won't talk about that. We were trained to hit people, but we don't do that anymore. So he hits him. So what does Magu do? Magu grabs the chisaku, grabs the stick with one hand and grabs another part of it with the other hand. He doesn't grab it away from Rinzai. He goes with Rinzai and they dance out of the room together. That's the story. They dance out of the room together. I don't know if it's the waltz or the foxtrot or what the Chinese did. They probably haven't even heard of the waltz and the foxtrot. They dance out together. So that Magu is, Dogen is talking about Magu because Magu knew how to make this place his very own. Right in the middle of someone trying to diss him, trying to get him, he is able to just join and go with. He's not passive. He doesn't lie down. He takes it and he goes with. He goes with. So that's why he's one of my favorite and one of Dogen's favorites. Shingetsu in the 18th century, the Zen teacher Shingetsu says about this story of the wind and the fan. This story certainly causes the wind even today. Magu swung the fan and the monk made a prostration. What is this? Says Shingetsu. What is this? So, what is this? What is this sense that we can make this very place our own when this place seems so confusing? What is this? Is it possible? Is it something made up? Is it a fabrication? Or is it, what is it? And what is preventing us from making this place our own? What about our thinking? What about our emotion? It's preventing us. What is it? This is a serious question in Zen. And that's the fourth pillar that I've been talking about. Four pillars of meditation is the what is it question. And if you do this practice, if you do this practice with sincerity, the what is it turns into a what is it? It's still what? It's the same what? What hasn't changed? You don't get anything pinned down. You don't get anything sure, but it's got some delight in it, some delight. So that's a second point that I think Dogen is making about this story. The third point I'll just talk about very briefly. Magu's answer is not verbal. Magu doesn't give a verbal answer. What does he do? He just fans, right? He just fans. In these Chinese stories, you very seldom get a nice Buddha nature at the end, a nice Atman at the end, a nice, oh, rest in stillness, all ye sinners at the end. You very seldom get that. Instead, there's action, bringing reality alive. And it's harder for you to pin down on some action and carry it away with you as being the true way. That's good, because the aliveness needs to be now. If it's not now, it never will be. It's only now, and it's already here. It's already here. So the Chinese Zen masters don't want to create any sense of us having some special place in here. This is the special place. This is it. And the third, oh no, the fourth. I had to write these down, I forget. The fourth point I think Dogen is making comes from Dogen's own history. Dogen started off as a Tendai monk. Tendai in China, Tendai in Japan. Very popular Buddhism at that time. Very popular with philosophically oriented people. Not popular in terms of Pure Land is really a popular stuff. But Tendai. Tendai is based on what? On Huayin. Tendai Buddhism is based on Huayin. Tendai Buddhism is based on Indra's net, the wonderful metaphor of Indra's net, right, which most of you are familiar with, in which each jewel reflects all the other jewels and is just what it is, just what it is. The more I am just what I am, the more I realize that I'm reflecting you and you're reflecting me, and we're one net. And that's a great teaching, and there's all kinds of texts and sutras written about that teaching, all kinds of examples, beautiful things and confusing things. So the Tendai monks study this stuff and give talks on it and all, and on and on and on, on and on. And so Dogen was ordained as a Tendai monk. But after a while, he began to feel that his angst about life, about his own life, about the suffering due to the fact that he had no parents. You know, he's 13 years old. He's 11 years old. He has no parents. He's 15-year-old adolescence, although maybe they didn't have adolescence then. They didn't have it in the way we have it, because people became monks very, very young, and they didn't have this adolescent rebellion stage. At least I don't think they did. Can't say for sure. So he wants something more, giving these eloquent lectures about Indra's net. So then he chooses Zen, because he knows that Zen is about doing a practice, about doing something more than just laying out some beautiful reality, but really doing a practice. And he knows that it's about doing a practice with a teacher. In Tendai, he had a couple of teachers, but they were so philosophical. It was just about learning stuff and then living that learning without the practice of meditation, without the practice of zazen. So the reason that I quit going to the Vedanta Center many, many years ago was that I wanted to do a practice. And with Suzuki Roshi, I could practice twice a day, except on Sunday. It was okay to take a break on Sunday. In Vedanta, there is a practice too. In the Vedas, there is a practice. If you go to the Meditation Center in North Minneapolis, you'll learn lots of practices, and I'm sure they're great. But in those days, if you wanted to do a Vedanta practice, you had to renounce the world. I would have had to renounce my love, my wife. I hadn't even married her yet, and already I was going to have to renounce her. I would have had to renounce doing a career. I was always interested in helping people in a social work psychology kind of way. I mean, not with a social work and psychology, but helping people. And I would have had to renounce that. I could have kind of helped people as a monk, but so I quit going to the Vedanta Center. Just went to Zen Center. So Dogen's point is that practice is very important. Practice is very important, and also for him, practice with a teacher is very important. And he says in Fukan Zazengi, choose a teacher who practices this way. These ancient sages practice this way, and then he says to, I don't know who he's talking to, how can you people refrain from practice? Maybe he's talking to all these Tendai monks, I don't know. How can you people refrain from practice? This is what it's about. It's about the simple practice of meditation, doing it over and over again until you actually experience more and more that this very place is your own. It just happens. But you have to just do it over and over. And you have to do it in some retreat settings, and you can do it daily too. But if you don't do it in some retreat settings, whether here or at another center, you won't have quieted your mind enough to begin to see it even in the geology room, which is full of a lot of stupid rocks. So no offense to Dogen. Dogen loved rocks. No offense to my teacher, Suzuki Roshi. He always talked about rocks. No offense to me. I love rocks too. But that was then. That was then. This is now. Right? So there are lots of good places to practice in the Twin Cities. The Twin Cities have changed so much since I came here many, many years ago when there was no place to practice. Then this became the first place to practice Zen or Buddhism in the Twin Cities. The first place. For years, we were the only place here. Now you've got a whole array of places and to go. Good teachers. Find a teacher and do it. Find a teacher and do it. Doesn't matter. Trust your gut. Hang out for a while and do it. You have this opportunity. You have it. So, the fifth point is one that is important for us in Soto Zen. Dogen says, when we sit in an upright posture, the entire universe becomes enlightenment. So this is instead of practicing in order to become enlightened. It's sitting up still, just as we are, and the universe manifests itself as enlightenment. Reality actualizes, becomes alive on its own. And I want to state a caveat to that teaching, which I don't know if Dogen would agree with or disagree with, because he's not here. Maybe he would agree, maybe he would disagree. When Dogen says that, don't get the impression that just taking an upright posture and worrying and planning and comparing the whole time is what he is talking about. I mean, you can come take an upright posture here every morning, and boy, you've got a whole hour to plan your day, to worry about who did what to whom and how you're going to deal with that. You've got a whole hour. But that is not what Dogen's talking about. I don't think, you guys. I don't think so. Because then, frankly, why bother? Why bother? Dogen is talking about doing it with bare attention. Bare attention. Bare awareness. And that practice of bare attention, of bare awareness, is not easy for any of us. For any of us. Till we have been doing it for a long time. Till we have really steeped ourselves in it. And so when I think Dogen means, when he says this, when he says, then when we sit in an upright posture in Zazen, the entire universe becomes enlightenment. I think he means in bare attention. And that's why I've been talking lately about bare attention, bare awareness being the third pillar, but you, as all of us, needing other pillars to support us. When our mind is so all over the place, and we're just sitting here and worrying about how we're going to deal with the fact that she wasn't nice to me, or I wasn't nice to her, or both of us weren't nice to each other. That we use those first two pillars. We use that pillar of immediate sense experience, of breathing, of posture, of sound in the room, whatever you choose. And then we use the second pillar of the positive mental dharmas when we need to encourage us. So that then we can get a sense of what Dogen's talking about when he says, sitting upright is enlightenment itself. So that's my caveat to what he says. But the reason he makes this point, and he's making this point sort of in contrast to Linchi, to Rinzai, because Rinzai Zen ultimately they both agree, but for a while they don't agree. Rinzai, the fierce guy who comes in and hits me, right? That guy talks about practice as in order to. I'm practicing in order to change my consciousness in order to open up to this huge reality, to die to everything that I believe in. And so it's all based on in order to. The carrot is out there, and if the carrot is seductive enough, you'll practice. If it's not seductive enough, you won't practice. If it doesn't look tasty enough or doesn't look within your grasp, you won't practice. And of course, when we get caught by that in order to, then we never make this place our very own, do we? We never make it our very own because it's always in order to. In order to. In order to. So I'm wearing today my blue rakusu. For those of you who are uninitiated, this is an initiation ceremony that I do with people and that my teacher did with me, where they make this and then we're given a name, and we wear this. Although, for me, I don't care if people wear it, but my teacher said, wear it. So, you know, everybody's different. And we're given a name. So my name, this is my original one. I have several of them. Depending on the style of the day, I decide. Well, today I'll have a blue style. You think I look nice in blue and black? I have a brown style, a gray style, although I like to call it silver, a silver style. That's better than gray. Right? Okay, enough of that. So I have my original Roxu on here from many, many, many years ago. I'm surprised it's got a little burn on the bottom here, but it's still okay. I must have been a good sewer. I must be a good sewer. Don't you think, Rosemary? Still here. And what does it say on the back? Oh, it's got a bunch of calligraphy. And then it says, Zen Tetsu. That's my name, Zen Tetsu, that my teacher Katagiri Roshi gave me, my second teacher, Zen Tetsu. So he gave me this teaching. He gave me, when your teacher gives you a name, it's meant to be a teaching. It's not just a name. It's meant to help you and support you in returning to making this place your very own. Because this is arduous. You think it wouldn't be arduous to learn how to make this place your very own? It seems simple, but for most people it's pretty arduous, pretty discouraging. So he gave me this, and he said, this is your name, Zen Tetsu. And it means thoroughgoing Zen. And I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. Wow, that's pretty good. And then I think he could tell that. I thought, oh, that's pretty good. He said, and it's not Zen Tatsu. And he said, this is a more important name for you than Zen Tatsu, Zen Tetsu. And I looked at him, he says, yes. And one of my friends in California was named Zen Tatsu. I won't talk about that part right now. I'll talk about that in another talk. He said, yes, Zen Tatsu is attainment of Zen. I want you to be Zen Tetsu. The teaching there for me was that I was always, in those years, trying to get somewhere. That's why I practiced so hard. That's why I practiced 6 days out of seven, and then usually on the seventh day. Because I was trying to get somewhere. But that's not bad. It's just natural. And I really wanted it. There wasn't much else I really wanted in my life. I surely didn't want geology. I surely didn't want a degree from college. I mean, I wanted what Suzuki Roshi had. That's what I wanted. And so I was ambitious. And to the point that I was a little bit competitive, maybe very competitive. Somebody said, you're very competitive. You get up so early. And I thought I was just getting up, but I don't know. Maybe I was competitive. My ego nature is competitive. I was the first child. I'm a boy. I played sports. I never got to be first because I'm so small, but I sure tried to be first. So he said, the name Zen Tatsu is okay, but if you were going to teach here, you are Zen Tetsu. So, thoroughgoing. Means what? This place is our very own. If you don't feel it's your very own, go into it. Go into it thoroughly. Thoroughly go into it. Thoroughly look at it. Thoroughly be with it. Thoroughly. Until you actually discover the what of it. It's no longer a what. It's a what. It's a what. Usually. Let's not get carried away with this. Then we'll have the new religion, the religion of what. So this is the end of Dogen's essay, Bringing Reality Alive by Making This Place Our Very Own. And that's all I need to say today, but I'm glad to entertain questions or comments or stories or songs or poems. We have some great poets here. Sure.
I have to admit to being a little confused by
this. This is your jewel? Oh. Don't forget your jewel is here. Yeah. Well, how can I talk about that? Genjo Koan means bringing reality alive. Reality is always right here. And yet we're creating alternative realities that we think will be better. We'll think we'll be healthier. We'll think we'll be better off. And that's partly because we don't see the radiance of this reality. We don't see it. We don't feel it. But he was reminding me that right here is Genjo Koan, is reality radiating always. And, of course, he would not have said that to me in my first month there. He said to me that after he had seen me in Sesshin, Sesshin means retreat, see me practicing for a couple years. And he thought I needed that reminder because I was so ambitious to get enlightened. Well, God, you read all these Chinese stories, that's all I talk about, right? Can you find one that doesn't talk, and then, after a while, I'm drooling. If, you know. Does that make sense?
Yes, it
does. Other people? Yeah.
Would you talk about the difference between the pillar, you talk about the four pillars, and the difference between physical dharmas and paying attention, and like where just the
pillars? Oh, yeah. Well, these pillars all collapse into one another, ultimately. But when we're talking about physical dharmas, bringing the physical, and this is old Buddhism, right? We're talking about physical dharmas into view. We're talking about focusing specifically on something physical to come back to this place, whether it be your breathing, your posture, your breathing and posture together. Could be the sounds around you. That's your immediate physical world, your immediate sensate world. Whereas in the third one, Shikan Taza, bare attention, you're not even paying attention to sensory or non-sensory. You're just watching everything. You're paying your attention to your thoughts, you're paying attention to spaces between your thoughts, you're paying attention to your emotions, to the birds, to your resistance. Bare attention.
So it's not cut up into separate.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. That's right. And my belief is that you shouldn't spend so much time doing that practice until you've calm enough to do it. It's better to work with the first two because you can just sort of go wild with the bare attention. You're really it's bare inattention is what it is. If you don't know what I mean, try it. That's my point. Does that make sense?
Are you saying that somebody could get kind of blissed out? Like, where?
No, I'm not saying you can get blissed out. I'm saying that bare attention, and you don't have to sit for years to do bare attention, but you have to be somewhat concentrated to do it. Because if you're not somewhat concentrated, you think you're doing bare attention, but you're gone 90% of the time. And if you're only here 10% of the time, it's better to work with one of the first two pillars to get you back here maybe 20% of the time. And then you can, or 30% of the time. Does that make sense?
A little.
But a little shit. Well, you want to say something more about it?
Well, I guess. What do you mean by gone?
You're in your storyline. I mean you're in your fabrications. Okay. Fabrication, fabrication, fabrication. Oh, yeah, I should be doing bare attention. Oh, bare attention. Then fabrication, fabrication. Oh, bare attention. Well, you do it. That, and then fabrication, worry, 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 concern, compare, plan the whole day out. What am I going to do with my grandson when I get home? What's going to happen at the board meeting? What do I have to report on? What am I not prepared for? What am I going to do tonight after I finally get out of this place? What kind of demands are my grandson going to? Oh, it'll be fun to see my grandson. Oh, I'd much rather think about my grandson than do bare attention. Oh, my grandson's bare. Oh, I'm supposed to be doing bare attention, right? That's what I mean.
Okay. You know, I think I read about this like study that they did with Tibetan monks, like when they were looking at their brainwaves. And so they had Tibetan monks meditating who were experienced meditators and maybe some people who weren't quite as experienced. And so when something passed by or a motorcycle passed by, they noticed the sound, but some of the people who were less experienced, they weren't noticing what was going on outside, you know, so they didn't pay attention to the motorcycle, where it seemed like the Tibetan monks were able to notice what was going on outside as well.
They noticed it, I know that study, and then they let it go. Their brainwave immediately went down to just calm. We're doing meditation now in the morning outside. for those of you who want to do it, five days a week. And I like that, but I'm concerned for beginners in meditation, because I think that some beginners, they get distracted then by someone walking by the street, and then they develop a story about it, and then they compare it to another story. And so I want everybody to go outside, but it's kind of like my concern about shikanta, is about bare attention. Sometimes you just need to really be reclusive until you can do this. But I still like doing outside. We're not going to change that. I'm just giving the caveat. I'm just saying there's that caveat. There's a caveat for everything. This is life, right? Anything else this morning, you guys? Yeah. The first one is immediate sensory awareness as your focus, whether it be breath or something else. The second one is using a phrase to bring you back, which you may repeat over and over again. It could be a mantra. It could be a gata. It could be something Steve said or something Suzuki Roshi read. You read about the Suzuki Roshi said. It could be your own invention, if it helps bring you back. The third one is bare attention, and the fourth one is deep questioning. Deep questioning. And that deep questioning is important, but I don't recommend that you guys get tripped out on that one too much, because it'll come up. It'll come up on its own. Already it's come up. You know, here it is, a beautiful Sunday morning, and you've been here for 2 hours or 1 hour. You might have to be here for 3 hours or 4 hours. So this questioning comes up. This questioning is good. It's good. But if we trip out on it, we're not using it to go deep so that we can burst the bubble of separation from just this. That questioning helps us do that, helps us burst the bubble of obsessive compulsive storytelling. If you don't have a question, you won't. But your question will come up. It always comes up.
So that's the final level, the final pillar.
Oh, sure, it's the final pillar, but there's no final pillar, and it's not a level. So, do you know what I mean? It's not a level. There aren't any levels. These are just metaphors. Yeah, just metaphors. Yeah.
So,
we have to do the chant. Oh, I see. Okay, well, let's just. Okay, so is that all everyone has? Okay, now I say thank you, and then we pass the bowl. Thank you.